Welcome to JW Podcast, the Watchtower Jenga of podcasts that takes down the organization one brick at a time.
Oh, good morning and welcome to JW Podcast. I've said good morning because I've got up at 6 o'clock in the morning to do this. And because it's another exciting Australian episode and we've got a really excellent guest on this week that's going to give us some fantastic, useful, positive information. But before we introduce our guest, I'll just introduce Lara, my co-conspirator. Good morning, Lara.
Good morning, Louise, and thank you for having us.
Because it's not morning where you are, is it? What part of the future are you in?
Well, I'm in Melbourne, and John, who has joined us, is in Queensland. So we're operating on three time zones. And can I introduce John for you?
Please go ahead.
So John Vandeleur is an accredited specialist personal injury lawyer, and he is one of the partners, I believe, at VBR Law. Is that right, John? You're a partner there?
Yep.
Okay. And I just wanted to quickly say that I live in the state of Victoria in the south, and John lives in Queensland in the north. And in Victoria, we have a beer called VB, and VB stands for Victorian Bitter. And John's company name used to be called VB Law. And they recently changed to VBR Law because they got a new partner. And that was a great relief to us. But I don't want to harp on that. I'm much more interested in his qualifications and his background and his experience. So I'll hand over to John to introduce himself properly. So we'll leave it to you, John, and then come back to me.
Thanks, Lara. And I am somewhat nostalgic about the loss of our VB status, but you know, times move on, and yes, we are VBR now, but those are all the letters of the alphabet we'll be adding for the time being. Yeah, thanks, Lara and Louise. I'm a solicitor, and I was admitted as a solicitor in 1994, and I've practiced ever since, pretty much in the field of personal injury compensation law, acting for claimants. Yes, I have an accredited accredited specialist with the Queensland Law Society, and I've held that since 2003. And so I've practiced in all forms of personal injury compensation over a long period of time. And as I guess I became more experienced, I suppose became exposed to more and more complex types of claim, mainly in the area of asbestos disease litigation and toxic torts, as they're called, so acting for people who are exposed to toxic substances and so forth, but predominantly asbestos. And with that comes a range of technical skills, I suppose, and knowledge and expertise, where you're dealing with a lot of historical evidence. The conditions are serious and occasionally terminal, so a great deal of sensitivity is required in dealing with and advising clients. And I suppose that experience provided a very solid platform for me when some years ago I came to start doing claims for compensation for survivors of institutional sexual abuse, which I've been doing now for some years, and particularly, I suppose, quite intensely for the last 2 years. So that's a little bit about me. Yes, we practice a firm in Brisbane. We just established it at the start of this year. Myself and some partners, former partners of a larger firm, we're all working for many years. And so we've struck it on our own, and we've got an office in Brisbane, one on the Gold Coast, and a visited office in Ipswich.
So did your work increase as a result of the Royal Commission then? Are you working in partnership with them, or is it just coincidence?
Well, we have a close relationship with the support organisation No More, KNOWMORE, which is a support group that was established and funded by the government to assist and support people in the commission process. And it, I suppose, is really through No More that we've worked with survivors quite a lot. Independently of that, just, I suppose, by reputation, we've done more and more of it. In general, I suppose there are two things that I guess would have contributed a lot to the amount of work that we're doing. The first one is But just generally speaking, and I perhaps you'll have the same experience, Louise in the UK and obviously Lara in Victoria, that the Commission, it's really been an extraordinary process in really allowing people to talk about, obviously, to talk about their experiences, but also in engendering a greater acceptance across all strata of society about just the scale of the problem and the acceptance of the truth of what people are saying. You know, whereas 5 or 10 years ago, you'd encounter a lot of skepticism from institutions and church groups and so forth about the veracity of claims, that has really been beaten down quite a lot. Because people have come to accept that just some really horrible things were happening and have happened, and people are more prepared to front up to that.
That is certainly true in our community, and it has really changed the landscape. And I'm just going to ask if I can just take you back a step and ask you a little bit more about your experience and qualifications, because I was in contact with someone who's very important to us. Their name will be withheld. But yeah. The reason why we're speaking to you today is because you were recommended. And what this person said about you was, you're an accredited specialist. You have the experience and the reputation. You're a genuine, compassionate and caring person. And this person happened to work as a paralegal in a big law firm. So they knew you can get lost in a big law firm. And their perception was that there's one chance at it, and they don't want to be taking that chance talking to a paralegal or a junior lawyer. So the question I've got for you was, what did they mean by an accredited specialist? What is the difference between for us, you know, we just don't understand what that means. So if you could explain that, I'd really appreciate it.
So the Queensland Law Society, which is our professional body, and in fact, all the law societies in Australia run a similar program of specialist accreditation. And so what that means is that to achieve specialist accreditation, you have to go through a rigorous examination. Well, you have to be peer-reviewed effectively. You have to be sponsored and approved by certain of your peers. You then go through quite a rigorous examination process involving, you know, a written examination, mock client interviews, the preparation and handling of a mock file to really test, with a whole lot of quirky and unusual things in it, to really test out your experience and skills. Yeah, and it culminates in an examination. And then all lawyers are required to have a certain amount of continuing legal education hours per year in order to maintain just their general legal qualification or the ability to practice as a lawyer. But accredited specialists have an additional requirement of hours to meet each year to maintain their specialist accreditation. And that's essentially that's a summary of accreditation. And yes, I've been doing that since 2003.
Okay. Thanks very much. That's good for us lay people who don't know. So it's kind of like the difference between, I don't know, a doctor and a specialist in surgery or something like that.
Yeah, look, that's right. I wouldn't put the specialist qualification that I have on par with the absolute rigor and years of qualification that a medical specialist has to go through. But certainly, I've been doing this for a number of years. And
so let me go back to what you were saying about No More. With No More, that was because I've made a submission into the Royal Commission. And the first place that I went to after I did that, I was referred to No More. And No More can refer you then to other law firms. And I noticed that your firm wasn't on the list at No More. So can you explain to me why that's the case, or help me to understand how people get onto the panel?
I'm not sure why our name didn't appear on that list. I mean, we get referrals from No More all the time. I've received referrals last week. I don't know whether that's an error or we're certainly a panel firm that receives referrals from No More. So I don't know whether their panel has been updated, or I suppose that panel has been going for some time, and when our firm was created, it was already existing. Perhaps they haven't added us on, but we're certainly, in close contact with no more. And I'm sitting at my desk now, and I see many files on my list that are all no more referred. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had the same query of Shine Lawyers about 6 months ago. They weren't on the list, and I can't remember how I made contact. Oh, it was through another survivor. And I asked them the same thing, and they said they weren't sure why. I think, well, they should have been on. And I contacted No More, and No More did add them onto the list. So I guess the importance of me asking that question is that people, I mean, law firms don't need to be on the panel to be referred from the Royal Commission. And even if you haven't made a Royal Commission submission, you can approach any law firm. And I guess that's what the message to get across today.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's right. I mean, No More specifically, its original role was to support people in the commission, although they do receive, as I understand it, significant inquiries from people outside the commission. But similarly, we act for and have acted for people who have come to us independently of No More, as I'm sure other firms do. But yeah, it's certainly good to work with No More because they, you know, they bring a lot of value adding to that, that referral process by really speaking to the clients to begin with, being able to collate some information and generally just making the person comfortable with that whole referral process. Yeah.
Yeah, they helped me. And again, I guess the message is that you can go to any law firm. However, No More can help refer you, but the Royal Commission is closing in December. And so therefore people don't have to wait to go through them. They can go direct.
That's right.
And in the first instance, we always would recommend that they go to the police and that they collate as much information as they can, whether that's through their friends, whether that's through their family, whether they've kept photos and diaries. The more that they have at their disposal, the more that they can then bring to you when they're ready for that.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah.
Okay. So now then I want to go back to, I guess, the question where Louise was alluding, and that is, how do you assist survivors of sexual abuse when they come to you?
Yeah, well, basically, to really break it down to its fundamentals, I mean, we recover compensation. That's what we do. And look, instantly with that comes recognition of the limitations of such a process. It is only money at the end of the day. And, you know, no amount of money could make anything better. But look, what we do find is that in a lot of cases, people have been greatly disadvantaged in their lives by these events, and the ability to have a lump sum does make an enormous difference to them. It doesn't make anything better, but it does make a difference to their lives and at the end of the day, it just does bring a certain level of closure in a way that various assurances from the churches and so forth that this will never happen again, you know, et cetera, and even apologies don't do.
It's like an acknowledgement, isn't it? It's a recognition that you've been wronged. This is separate to getting the perpetrator separate to criminal justice, isn't it? But it's
correct.
It's still an acknowledgement, I think. It's some kind of recognition that you weren't going crazy, that it wasn't your fault, and that you weren't just being a crazy person.
That's right. And there is an empowerment in the process itself. I'm not in the business of, you know, encouraging people to just litigate for the sake of it, but there is an empowerment in it. And the person who was once the victim, I don't like to use that word, but you know, is now, that they have a certain amount of control. They are the claimant. They are bringing the process. The church or other institution is subject to the process. The parties are on equal footing before the law. And it's a very, very empowering thing in my experience, at least insofar as acting for these people, for people who's concerned. And in one sense, the payment of the money, that's important, but that's, it's part of it, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, John, the empowerment, like you mentioned earlier, that people are talking about it, and you also mentioned people are accepting of what happens. Louise, you've just mentioned, you know, the validation and the empowerment. And I'm not sure you know this, John. You probably do, but you mentioned you might like to learn a few things from us. And what Louise and I have learned is that education rates are very low amongst Jehovah's Witnesses and ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. And poverty is very high amongst Jehovah's Witnesses and ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. And there are also...
That it, as far as women are concerned,
It's everybody because they don't allow... Well, they are very sensorial of anyone who does further education that's not compulsory. So most witnesses, like myself, would stop at the soonest point you're allowed to stop education because you have to devote your life to God. Now, I personally went back to university later on after I was married, so I'm not a poor ex-Jehovah's Witness, but I was a window cleaner. So if I hadn't gone back, I would have been very poor. And that wasn't just because I was a woman, although that's compounded if you're having children. That's for all Jehovah's Witnesses are pretty poor.
Okay.
And John, so I think it's important to say, because somebody asked me yesterday, they knew that I was going to speak to you, and they said, and I said to them, what would you like to ask? And they said to me, not a question so much, but just to let people know that if someone is saying you will be successful and you have a case that cannot fail, to be cautious of that. So apparently some people have been promised you will be successful and you can't fail, and that's not always the case. So I think it depends on, as I mentioned before, your level of documentation. I didn't mention, but you need to be able to corroborate your case. You also need a good lawyer, obviously, and you need to have a stable case and a case that you can prove in law. And I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that, but just, you know, that we should make promises.
Yeah, look, that's absolutely correct. And I think that there is a sense in which this area could be perceived as being, oh, well, you know, you just go up and tell your story and get some money. I mean, while I stand by what I said earlier about a more benevolent climate for the bringing of these claims, I certainly wouldn't want to give the impression that it's anything like that. At the end of the day, it comes down to the credibility of the narrative or history that the claimant is giving. And yeah, we are trying to look for, I suppose, you know, ideally, circumstantial things that might go to assist the acceptance of that version. So going from really obvious things like a person who is alleging abuse, the person they say that abused them is known to have committed abuse before, at a similar time and a similar era. Some more, I suppose, indirect things like, you know, I have a case at the moment where this fellow was abused out of school, and we're able to show that there was a marked deterioration in his behavior, his school results, his sporting performance, all these things, not long after he said these events occurred. So again, it's not obviously not proof, but it goes to the credit of the claimant, I think. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Certainly complaints to the police are helpful, although I understand people are very reluctant about that. But, you know, that is a recommendation I give, as you do, because at the end of the day, these are crimes. These are serious, serious crimes.
We want to break the cycle for the next generation, and that's why we do this. So, John, can I ask you to take us through how your claim process would work?
Yeah.
And if I ask you to do that and, you know, start with your phone number and, you know, who answers the phone and what you kind of ask, and then maybe if I give you, like, a scenario of what you do if someone with this example that I've got in the back of my mind, let's see if we can work through. But I've got your phone number here, and it's 07... which is Queensland, then 3379-2513. Is that the phone number that people would call? Have you got a 13 number?
You've got a 1-800 number as well. Yeah, it's 1-800-316-716. Or if people want to, sometimes people prefer to email in the first instance, and anyone can email me at john@vbrlaw.com.au.
Okay, thanks. And if they call you in the first instance on 1-800-316-716 or email you, What's the first, I guess, triage that they go through? What do you consider? What do you ask them for?
Look, I just ask them about their story. I don't particularly, I'm not in any great rush about signing them up to something. I just like to talk to them. Now, obviously, this is highly sensitive material. Someone's calling a lawyer. They're a bit nervous about the process in the first place. And so obviously that needs to be handled with some sensitivity. But I just like to get a bit of a sense of what people are calling about.
Do you kind of go through a bit of a questionnaire? So, for example, do you ask them if they meet the terms of reference of the Royal Commission, or do you ascertain that?
No, not particularly. I mean, I think just in the course of letting people tell their story, I can kind of, in my own mind, I suppose, you know, I'm thinking about the various criteria and that sort of thing. But I don't tend to burden people with a whole lot of legal detail in that conversation. I like to really find out what the whole thing is about. I guess see what documents. Sometimes people have a lot of their own documents, and that's good. And I might even get them to send me those so I can just have a bit of a look. And then probably I'd arrange to meet with the person and, they can come to my office or very regularly we're going out and about to all sorts of places to see people. Yeah, but I guess in the first instance, I just really want to hear the story. That's the main thing. I don't, without any particular structure, the structure can sort of come later. And I can get a bit of a sense of what I might be able to do. And then we can sit down and talk more and more about the process, you know, as once I feel that there is something I can do, yeah, and go from there.
Okay. And so we mentioned before you're in Queensland. And so are your clients all based in Queensland? Because I know, for example, that that's your specialty and that's where you operate and you know the laws there. Mm. So that's where you focus, we assume?
Yeah, basically. Practice and procedure and some of the laws are different in Queensland to the other states of Australia. It might seem extraordinary to Louise living in a country with, you know, four times the population but none of these sort of strange jurisdictional barriers. So, you know, yeah, you go across the Tweed River into New South Wales and that's a different system. But nevertheless, we do act for people interstate who have been abused in Queensland. And so, but generally speaking, it tends to be events that have occurred in this state. I have done a couple of matters where the abuse has occurred interstate and I've been able to approach the relevant institution in that instance and just resolve things informally. But that's not particularly common, yeah.
I think Louise thinks it's hilarious that you and I can drive for 4 to 6 hours and still be in the same state, still be in the same country.
Yeah.
I think you're making it up. You're so far away. How can we ever prove that that's the case?
Louise will drive 2 hours and be in the next country, so it's hard for her. But Louise was born in Australia, so
she's so I should really believe you.
Yeah.
If I ask you like a scenario, and I'm putting you on the spot here, but if I asked you a scenario, kind of what do you do with that? So you've just kind of explained you want to hear the story. So if I tell you a story.
Yeah, go on.
And this is a true story, but I've given you absolutely no notice that I was going to ask it. But I have a friend and her ex-partner was a Jehovah's Witness who was abused by his father.
Yep.
And he committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
As a consequence of the abuse that he suffered. And his children, who are now adults, he committed suicide only a few years ago. His children who are adults, would they have a claim? So if I was his daughter and I rang you and I said, my dad was abused and he committed suicide, do I have a claim? Can you help us to understand how you'd treat that?
Look, I think it would be it's a technically somewhat difficult claim, but I think it's certainly worth looking at. What I would say is that I suppose in law, one of the big problems in law is causation. So how are events related? So, and superficially, while there might be a relationship, when you dig down, you know, in an evidentiary sort of way, you know, sometimes those causal connections can sort of break down. But I suppose what you'd probably want to see in a scenario like that is where the deceased was having some counselling in his life and had, or at least it is able to be established either through witnesses, and I guess his wife would be able to give this evidence, that it was a massive, it was a major problem to him, you know, the fact that this abuse had occurred, that it was a major problem to him, that of all the, so you want, I think it'd be something like, you need to get evidence from a psychiatrist to say that, looking at all of this, while no one can ever really know, on the balance of probabilities, the abuse that has happened has materially contributed to his suicide, which, after all, is not sadly not an unheard of event at all. I suppose the other thing to just flag about this, and this is, I noticed this a little bit with Jehovah's Witnesses type matters, is that, and I'm not saying that this is what has happened here, but there are two distinct things here. There's the abuse that has occurred. Now, this fellow that was abused by his father, it may be that the church itself is not liable for that abuse having occurred in the first instance. Now, there could be exceptions to that. That is to say, the church might be aware that this father had some predisposition or some prior inclinations or events or crimes in that regard and has done nothing about it. Now, if that evidence is available, and sometimes it is, then, you know, the church would have a liability. If it's just happened, albeit that the father is a member of the church, if it's just sort of happened, then the church is not going to be liable in a common law sense for that. But what we then see, of course, in these matters is a failure by the church to act to address this, to address the problem once they become aware of it, and in fact cast the sufferer in a position of shame and kind of blame and that sort of thing, and they can be liable for that. Now, in a compensation sense, I suppose what that means is that the whole condition that arises from all of these events, the church may not be able to compensate that, but they might be liable to compensate a portion of it. And I think from that point of view, I think that at least technically, if any of those things are present, then the children, the dependents of the deceased would be able to do something about it.
John, that's really interesting. What you've described is a kind of Jehovah's Witness situation. So I realise you'll have dealt with all different groups and religions,
yeah,
as well as witnesses. But our main issue with the Jehovah's Witness religion is this thing of when children have reported to elders, they've had this two witness rule where the elders won't do anything else if there aren't two witnesses, which paedophiles rarely have witnesses present when they act, in my vast experience.
Correct.
Of these matters. So it always stops there. Oh, there's not another witness, so we can't do anything. So in those situations, so what Jehovah's Witnesses say is, oh, well, abuse happens in all religions and groups. And the same as if you were a member of a chess club and there was somebody there that just happened to be an abuser. It's not the chess club's fault, right? But it might be if then somebody tells the chess club and they refuse to do anything. That's the difference that Jehovah's Witnesses don't understand. So when you say your religion's got an abuse problem, they say, oh, well, there's abuse in all groups and religions, and they don't realise the next step, that often there has been a report to the elders that's then been hidden and covered up. And that's the subtle difference. So I just wondered, in your experience, is there anything that you've noticed about dealing with the Jehovah's Witnesses that's particularly difficult?
Look, I'm new to claims against the Jehovah's Witnesses, and I have a number under investigation that haven't actually pulled the trigger, as we say, on any of them yet. I have, but we're close. I've dealt with very similar situations in other church organisations, including the Catholic Church, which, in some ways, well, I guess they all have this problem. These church groups, in that they established their own process. You know, they established their own process and they see themselves as being really the final arbiters of all of this. And it's a really a fundamental breach of the principle of separation of church and state. But nevertheless, that's how they did it. And in fact, in the case of the Catholic Church, which I know quite a lot about for a layperson, that was entrenched in law. I mean, in some ways, their own inherent structure gives them the ability, so they think, to avoid scrutiny and so forth. Fortunately, that's been broken down a lot of late. But
I remember when, I mean, I was a Jehovah's Witness till I was 30, so I've got quite a lot. I remember believing that God's law was absolutely more important than the, you know, than man's law. And we kind of looked down on human law in a sneering way, like it was a pathetic and an imperfect attempt at bringing some structure to society, whereas God's law was absolute and perfect and absolutely trumped anything. And I remember believing that deeply. And actually, John, a really weird thing is that I went and did a law degree while I was still a Jehovah's Witness, and I still had that thought process, you know, that God's law trumped it all while I was studying law as a non. So the other problem, of course, with Jehovah's Witnesses is that they do have this shunning thing where if you leave, everybody cuts you off, and that is terrifying, utterly, utterly terrifying for people to contemplate. So for me, when I left, it was fairly easy because I didn't have anyone, a family to lose. But for most people, they can't even begin to contemplate losing everybody. And that stops them acting in any capacity. And I just wondered, is that something you've come across with the few cases that you've dealt with so far?
Definitely. And that's absolutely right. And one thing that you really... Well, which is no more than just saying what you just said, but one thing you, one real abiding characteristic of Jehovah's Witness communities that you notice is it's just all encompassing. You know, there's no, every human interaction is with another member of the church in a way. Well, you get the sense that's how they'd prefer it. That's how the powers that be would like it. I mean, obviously that's not able to be done every day, but yeah, so, people are dealing with businesses that are Jehovah's Witnesses. People are dealing, you know, there's that sort of thing. And look, that's certainly true of other religions, denominations as well, but it just seems to be a real, it just, that really comes through, talking to Jehovah's Witness, or ex-Jehovah's people. And, you know, you can really see how they could engender that type of climate that you're talking about, that it's sort of this kind of sealed off world, and to step outside it, something is something horrible and alien.
Louise, did you see the news yesterday that there was a Portuguese girl who committed suicide after simply preparing for herself to be disfellowshipped?
No, I didn't see that. How terrible, but believable.
And so, I mean, I'd like to pay my respects to her family and friends, but and I'm sure you'll see it in the ex-Jehovah's Witness news. But, John, that girl committed suicide because she believed that she would be disfellowshipped. And is certainly what is stopping people from coming forward. And so not only do we encourage people to come forward, go to the police, seek a lawyer and find some justice, but we also want people to come forward who can corroborate. And I have been successful in some ways but unsuccessful in others to try and get people to come forward in the first instance to tell their story. But even if you don't have a story yourself, to come forward and corroborate somebody else's story, because just everybody knows someone who has been abused. And I struggle to find a single person who doesn't know someone. So this is a call for people to come forward to help corroborate other people's stories. I'd like to ask you, so we just talked about what the claim process involves, and they can call you or they can email you and then you ask them their story. And you discussed about causation and about how costs can be apportioned, and particularly evidence from a psychologist, if that's material, how they can make a claim. So can you help us to understand how compensation is calculated?
Yeah, sure. So compensation is assessed in relation to what's called common law principles. Those are the principles that have been developed by the courts over many years, firstly in England and then received into Australia, in the various states of Australia. And at least I can say those principles are fairly common, needless to say, across all Australian jurisdictions and in England. So basically, compensation is when you see someone in court awarded a sum of damages, as it's called, that's a total figure made up of a number of different components. And there are a number of traditional components of damages, including an amount for pain and suffering. I'll come back to these in a minute, but past loss of income, future loss of income, past medical expenses, future medical expenses. So pain and suffering is a fairly archaic sort of term, but basically it just goes to the person's subjective experience of the anguish and the pain and so forth that they've been through. But the actual amounts you get for that are nothing. It's a very meager sum of money for that type of experience. And in Queensland, for example, $50,000 would be quite a significant award for pain and suffering, not just in relation to so-called psychological effects, but also in, you know, just even with motor vehicle accidents and quite serious injuries, although they can be higher. Where we tend to find significant awards is in the whole financial or economic loss aside. So where to take abuse claims, for example, we often have people coming to see us 20, 30 years or so or more after it's happened. And their lives over that time have followed, not all the time, but in many cases have followed a troubled path. Trouble with the law, difficulty forming relationships, substance abuse, and as part of or as a consequence of all of those things, the ability to maintain consistent employment. So one of the things we're doing, for example, is to look at the actual earnings of a person over the years, compare those earnings with the earnings of a scenario that's reasonably consistent with a smoother or more successful transition into adult life and claiming the balance. Now, that can get even more complicated where other stressors might be present. So you mentioned Louise, for example, in the case of the Jehovah's Witnesses, of the whole structure kind of acting to the impoverishment of its members. But as bad as that is, that's not something the church can be liable for. So one of the things that we're trying to divine out are what the economic effects are of the actual abuse. And there are various ways we can try and do that. But that's where it starts. We're comparing the actual scenario with a better scenario and trying to claim as much of that difference as we can. And so as to the past, for the future. So to the extent that the person has a period of time for retirement age, and many people do, you know, we're seeking to claim an amount for the future. And even where someone has had a reasonably successful working life despite the abuse that they've suffered, and to many people's credit that happens. Nevertheless, if they've got another 15 years of working life left, these events can add a certain brittleness weakness or in their resilience, and it may be that they won't be able to continue with their otherwise successful career over that remaining period of time, and so we might look at claiming something for that potential disadvantage.
And so as you've been talking about all that, I'm sure Louise, you were assessing yourself against all that stuff, and I was certainly assessing myself. And as you started to talk, John, I thought, I was a teenage alcoholic.
Yeah.
I changed jobs every year. I haven't been able to sustain a relationship. And I'm middle-aged now. So if we were able to quantify that, and Louise mentioned before, she was a window cleaner and she could have been a highly successful accredited specialist personal injury lawyer.
Well, we don't know that. We don't know that.
But it certainly sounds familiar, I guess. And so what I understand from some of my survivor friends is that they actually get this assessed, and this gets assessed by someone like a psychiatrist or psychologist, and they actually come up with a report, and you can use that report in court or through negotiations with the Watchtower, is my understanding.
Yeah, that's right. So what we do is, firstly, we try and identify the loss. So as I said to one of my clients once, you know, the scenario we're comparing it to is not you as Bill Gates, you know. It's just a scenario that's reasonably consistent with a somewhat smoother path to adulthood, because a theoretical judge is always going to say, well, look, everyone in their lives, no matter how good their childhood was, always runs into the slings and arrows and the ups and downs that are just part of everyday life. And so, you know, it's not going to be an idealized scenario, but nevertheless, we identify that. And we might get a forensic accountant, they're called, a specialist accountant, who can go back and prepare a report looking at that historical income, go back and look at the wages, awards, and so forth to calculate that sort of scenario. Or if someone's, of course, thought that they might have been able to go to university, what a scenario consistent with that is like. And then, yes, and from there we get the psychiatric evidence to say, well, this abuse or whatever conduct, or the cover-up or other things that the church has done has materially contributed to that loss. And then, as you say, yes, we go from there to formulate a position and then put that to the church within the framework of our process here, which is a pre-court process. So in Queensland, there's a pre-court process that we use, a very good process where there's a particular way of notifying the claim in a particular type of form, disclosing all the documents we have, submitting an offer, an assessment of damages, and an offer to the respondent, in this case the church. And then the parties are required to have a mandatory sit-down settlement meeting discussion before proceedings can be commenced in court. I mean, hopefully that meeting resolves the claim, but if it doesn't, then the parties can then commence a claim in court, yes.
One of the criticisms I've heard from Jehovah's Witnesses when there have been claims is, oh, they're just doing it for the money. And yeah, that long and lengthy process that you've described, and the fact that your case does have to be a provable case. It's not just, as you said, somebody rocking up and saying, oh, I was abused and I need a bit of money. It's not that at all. People can't do that. And so I think it's a way of witnesses protecting themselves against the thought that there might be an actual abuse problem. That if you can minimise it and make flippant comments like, oh, there's abusers in all religions, or, oh, they're just doing it for the money, that protects them from the thought that there might be a significant problem among witnesses.
And I think that's really valid for the people listening because, you know, I used to think that. And like you said before, you think, oh, no, you know, God's law is higher than man's. And then you also think, no, there can't be anything wrong with us. And, you know, it wasn't until just a year ago that I worked out they were really wrong. You know, they were really doing the wrong things. So I think that's really valid.
Well, we do try and build as much rigor as we can into these claims from our end, because we want to present a very strong and credible position. So, you know, we use highly regarded specialists in all fields to, if we're getting evidence and yeah, we, you know, what is presented at the end of the day is a highly professional, well, you'd hope so, but a very, very compelling presentation, I suppose. So yeah, that's where we want to get to. And yeah, if you were just really turning up and rolling the armor over and just seeing, you know, seeing what was going to happen and just throwing, so just splattering something out there, it's just not going to work. I mean, they do have a more benevolent approach to the institutions these days, but they're no pushovers.
Laura, have you got anything that you'd like to ask John before we wrap up?
Yes, I've got a couple more questions, John. I don't know how you're going for time. I know we're over time. Can I ask a couple more?
Probably got about 5 more minutes, Laura.
Okay, great. I just wanted to ask about time limits, because we know that the statute of limitations were amended in Queensland.
Yeah.
So if we could understand from you, what are the time limits for which people need to make a claim?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the limitation period, I was right at the start when I was talking about two different factors that have led to a greater number of claims. One is the greater the better societal attitude to these things. The second is this change in the limitation period. Now, in Queensland, there used to be a 3-year period of limitation that applied to all claims for damages for personal injury, which is ultimately what these are. And but in the case of children, the period wouldn't start till they turned 18, till they became legal adults. But that was still of no avail, because very often these people would be well into their 30s, 40s, 50s and older before they would be prepared to really face up to all of this. And of course, by that time, the period which effectively expired on the 21st birthday had long expired. So the Queensland government along and all the state governments in Australia, I think, I think everyone's on board now, have removed the limitation period completely. It just doesn't apply. It doesn't apply. This is only in respect of sexual abuse. Now, a little issue that does arise, and I was talking about this with one of my Jehovah's Witness clients not long ago, was that does the period of limitation removal apply just directly to claims for actual sexual abuse, or does it also cover inadequate responses by institutions to that abuse? I mean, I think it's definitely the latter. I think looking at the Act is wide enough to cover everything, and I would certainly not discourage any person who wanted to talk about their potential rights from doing so, because just on that basis, I mean, that's a lawyer's problem, and that's something we could look at. I'm just saying that that's, you know, perhaps a little issue, but generally speaking, the limitation period has been removed, so there's really no problem as far as all that's concerned.
Thank you, John. Now, Louise, did you get the chance to ask your most important question? Because I've got one more.
Yeah, I did, but I just want to ask you one. It's a really quick yes or no question. I just wondered, the clients that you deal with that are Jehovah's Witnesses, are they still Jehovah's Witnesses, or are they always ex-Jehovah's Witnesses?
Always ex at this point.
That's exactly what I would have thought. I don't believe any Jehovah's Witness would approach the law in or any legal help or anything.
Thank you. So, John, just before I ask my question, Louise, if it's okay, John's got to go, but I'd like to tell you a couple of news stories and some requests by media to talk to them after, because John's got to go. But just before I ask my final question, I'd like to play a song at the end of this. And today I have been listening to the Dixie Chicks. They're an American band. And I've been listening to the song Not Ready to Make Nice. So I thought that that would be quite pertinent to today's podcast. So after John and we finish our news, it would be really good to play that song Not Ready to Make Nice. So, John, if you haven't heard that song,
yeah, I think it's I know the band.
Yeah, the band is awesome. So it would be really good to play that song, and I can send you the link afterwards so you can enjoy the video clip too. It was about a statement that they were making, a political statement. So I'm not trying to make that, but I am saying we are not ready to make nice. We need to go to the police and find a lawyer where it's appropriate to help us. So we appreciate you coming. I've got a really quick question. To wrap up, and that is, how long does the process take? So we talked about how we can approach you, and you talked about how involved the process may be, and we talked about how to calculate compensation. How long does this take? 2 or 3 years?
Well, no. I mean, I think that there's a couple of, probably if there's any delay, the process itself is not a particularly lengthy process. I mean, what I'm talking about here is the pre-court process to get up to that meeting, that settlement conference meeting. Often what we're finding is what takes a while is getting all the records that we want. So, you know, getting all the records in, you know, we get first the person to authorize us, and we go off and do that. But for various reasons, if you're getting records from government departments and so forth, you know, there can be a period of, 2 months doing that. And then you want to brief your specialist. So, look, you're probably looking at about 6 months on average before you were ready to get it off the ground. But at that point, you'd hope to be in a position where you could put your full offer to the church or whatever institution you're claiming against. And I think that probably, yes, look, 6 to 9 months, you'd hope to be in that position. And then it's really up to them to do what they want to do. So they might want to have you examined, have the claimant examined by their own psychiatrist, for example. And perhaps that can take a while because, you know, those appointments don't grow on trees. So probably another 4 to 6 weeks, maybe 2 months to get that appointment. And then once they've got any evidence they want to get, then we can have that sit down. Now, of course, does that guarantee that the matter will resolve at that point? No. I mean, ultimately, they have to offer something that the claimant's without advice is prepared to accept. And sometimes that won't happen. But generally, what we find is that the institutions are quite willing to try and resolve these things, assuming they're credibly based and reasonably presented and so forth.
Thank you very much. That was so educational, and I think a lot of people will really appreciate your time and just understanding it from our specific perspective.
Thank you so much, John. We really appreciate your time.
It's a real pleasure. It's great to electronically meet you both, and I wish you well in all your efforts, and you're doing a great thing here, and it's a real honour to talk to you and to know that you guys are out there fighting the good fight.
Hey, that's exactly what I was going to say to you.
Well, we're all in it together, huh?
Thank you for all your work. And I know the entire ex-Jehovah's Witness community are grateful for professionals like yourself who support us and help people get their cases through. And the best of luck for all of your cases.
Thanks, Louise. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks, Lara. All the best.
So I've got three little stories, but also I butted in a lot, so I just want to make sure that you get equal time.
No, it's fine. That's fine. I'm good.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to share three things with you. The one thing I think you'll already know about is, you know, you've got a friend by the name of Lydia Finch, and I've mentioned her name before, and she told me about her Finally Awake YouTube clip, and I've been watching the numbers grow on her clip, and I wanted to tell you something just in case you didn't know. She now has passed 15,000 views.
God.
So I want you to pass on my congratulations when you see her next.
Brilliant. I will do. And I want Lydia on the show because she's like a quiet activist. I say quiet, yes. She's hitting 15,000, but she travels around the country giving talks to different groups, atheistic groups and, you know, thinking groups. And she's really interesting, but kind of doesn't hit the radar.
Yeah, I felt so comfortable with her and I felt that I had a lot in common with her. And under the radar is the term that comes to mind. She's far too humble. And I recommend watching her YouTube clip, Finally Awake. So that's my first bit of news that I'd like to let you know. I've got a second bit of news, and I'm apologising here because this is all antipodean now.
As you said, we're happy down under. Keep going.
Yeah. We've had a call out from two places for stories. So the first one that I want to tell you about is the ABC News. And ABC have two journalists, one by the name of Julia Baird, and the other's name is Hayley Gleason. And they have asked for people to contact them about domestic violence. So I just want to quickly read out to you what Hayley wrote to me because I contacted her. She said, "Thank you very much for your email. My sincere apologies for taking so long to reply. Sadly, we've been inundated with messages from people who've experienced abuse in the church. We are hoping to look at Jehovah's Witnesses at some point. If you'd like to share some of your stories, we're specifically focusing on domestic abuse. Perhaps you can send a few details regarding how many cases, what happened, when and where it happened, was any action taken by JW leaders, etc." So I have shared this with a number of sites and with our secret groups, and I hope that people listening to this in Australia can please write in. They have an email address that they've posted, and it's Hayley Gleason with the ABC. So that's the second news story. Now, Louise, you and I spoke to a lady by the name of Rachel Jackson recently. Do you remember Rachel had tonsillitis? She has recovered. And so, again, she's down to the voice. So she told me yesterday that there is an independent journalist in New Zealand and Rachel's been talking to her. So this independent journalist, her name is Amy Parsons King. It's hyphenated. Amy Parsons King. She's pitching a story on the abuses of our Kiwi JWs. So she's interested to speak with a survivor of sexual abuse in New Zealand, someone who's being shunned by their family for it and is willing to speak out. Now, Rachel is really passionate, if you remember, about human rights abuses and about the issue of Watchtower claiming, you know, they've got a tax haven set up, basically. So, you know, Rachel's really keen to help this independent journalist. So Amy Parsons King has already submitted the request to make a short documentary, and she wants to interview a survivor on how their complaint was handled. There's a realization, though, it's a much bigger story here, and she's keen to independently make a full-length documentary. And that just reminded me, I've actually got a full story today. I just realized, sorry.
No, don't be sorry.
Yeah. Do you remember last time, a couple of times ago, we were talking about the Canadian case and it was a class action? We talked about it in a little bit, but not very much detail. But just overnight, actually, there has been a story come out by Trey Bundy. Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen. What have I been doing?
You've got nothing to catch up on, Louise. You have busy recording and posting podcasts.
Look, Lara, you're my PA. You feed me this information and I'll read it.
Okay, so I'm really happy to report that Trey Bundy has done another Watchtower story, and it is about our friends in Canada and their class action. So I won't say any more, but please go and have a look at Reveal News and have a look at what they've released. And that's all I've got to say.
That's great. Yeah. No. Stop. We love listening to you talk.
Yeah. And, you know, today we talked about Canada. We talked about New Zealand. We talked about Portugal. And I want those kind of smaller places or larger to have a voice. And thank you for giving us that platform.
Well, it's the very least I can do. All I do, Larry, is I just sit here and drink coffee and let the thing roll. And it's a pleasure to be able to do that. But yeah, it'd be great if we could get those smaller countries in, you know, the European countries, if we could have a significant activist kind of representing those countries and presenting stories and being a voice for the people that are leaving Jehovah's Witnesses in those countries to go to. I know there are things going on everywhere. It's just finding out about them, isn't it, and connecting up.
I'd love to hear from the Polish people. You know, the ones who tricked up their bus, you know, they had a whole lot of signs and they had a, what did they call it, manifesto. I'd love to hear from them. And I'd also love to hear how to go in New York. They're going to hold a protest in New York next month. So it'll be good.
Yeah, there will be a podcast on that. There'll be a post dissection podcast on that. I've got a man on the ground.
Excellent. So I'm going to roll off, but I can't wait to hear the song Not Ready to Make Nice.
Yeah, and me. Thank you so much, Lara. And thank you to both of our viewers for listening to another JW podcast. Goodbye.
Bye.
True, could they say time heals everything? But I'm still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price, and I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. I probably wouldn't if I could, 'cause I'm
in my bed and I sleep like a baby with no regrets, and I don't mind saying it's a sad, sad story when a mother will teach her daughter that she ought to hate a perfect stranger. And how in the world can the words that I said stick in somebody so over the edge that they'd write me a letter saying that I better share everything or my life will be over. Time heals everything, but I'm still waiting.